The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
You know, and I have trouble with this word political, right? What would you expect political institutions to engage in if not politics? But the things that sort of look political in the way people are using it in that sense are the things that are meant to sort of directly engage with the public. And we want Congress to engage with the public. We want Congress to both reflect public opinion, help to shape public opinion, if it's ever going to be able to sort of stand up to the other branches. It's got to do so by enlisting the public on its side, and it's got to therefore engage in effective communication with the public. And so my argument in this article is that a lot of, you know, that the tools of congressional oversight give it ways of effectively engaging with and convincing the public, and that when it can successfully use those tools, it has sort of empowered itself in really important ways.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 9th, 2020. High-profile congressional hearings, like the 2015 Benghazi hearings, the 2019 Mueller report hearings, and most recently the Ukraine impeachment proceedings, are often described in derogatory terms like political theater, spectacle, circus. But do these exaggerated performances on Capitol Hill actually serve a constitutional purpose? I sat down with Josh Chaffetz, a law professor and author of the book, Congress's Constitution, Legislative Authority, and the Separation of Powers. We talked about his most recent article in which he argues that congressional overspeech, like congressional oversight, is actually an important tool of constitutional politics, even if it doesn't automatically produce good outcomes. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 9th, Congressional Overspeech with Josh Chaffetz. So, Josh, I want to start with a moment that I remember from about a year ago, a little less than a year ago. It was when Robert Mueller's testimony concluded in July, and all of the news coverage was about how the testimony and the hearings were sort of a failed performance. All of the news coverage was focused on that. Not much of the news coverage focused on the facts that were being talked about in the context of the hearings, the facts from the report that Robert Mueller was being asked to, you know, speak to. It was really all about this sort of performance aspect of the hearings. That moment really crystallized for me, in essence, a huge part of what congressional oversight has become. Did you have a similar moment like that at that time, or in response to some other set of congressional hearings that got you interested in writing this article?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've been thinking about this particular issue for a little bit longer than that, but I think that really was a great crystallizing moment where the discourse really became about the performance. And a lot of the discourse about the performance took place in a very sort of tut-tutting tone. You know, how dare people focus on the performativity of it and not on the facts or something like that. And that, I think, is part of what spurred me to actually write this piece, because facts don't exist in the absence of sort of their being talked about, right? There's no such thing as just a sort of fact about the world that motivates people to behavior. That fact has to be sort of framed and packaged and described and performed. And so I wanted to sort of take that discourse and suggest that, yes, that is the case with the Mueller testimony, but that's always the case, whether we recognize that it's happening or not. And therefore, the people engaged in this, whether we're talking about Mueller himself or whether we're talking about the members of Congress and their staffs who are producing these hearings, need to be cognizant of that. They can't just assume that the facts by on their own will have motivating force.
So I want to take you back much further back in time to the time of the Founding Fathers and the 18th century into the 19th century. In your very good article that you wrote, you sort of talk about that time period and what congressional oversight sort of consisted of, that it was more sort of a grand inquisition kind of a model. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about that. How was congressional oversight and sort of the performative aspects of Congress's work conceived of during that time frame?
Sure. Well, we can even go back a little bit further. So the language of the grand inquest of the nation actually comes out of the 1730s and debates about the role of the House of Commons in Britain. And there was this idea that as you had the sort of development of British democracy, the development of the idea that the ministers of the crown were actually answerable to Parliament, that it was the House of Commons that served as a sort of overseer, as the grand inquest, and not just in the sense of potential wrongdoing, but even just in terms of if things went wrong, if bad things happened, it was the job of the House of Commons to try to figure out why and whether someone should shoulder the blame for it. So then this idea sort of gets picked up first in the colonial American assemblies, which had a very adversarial relationship in many contexts with the royal governors. And then it gets sort of continued through into the new American Republic. And we see this starting very early. So in 1792, the first major congressional hearings are these hearings into the failure of the St. Clair expedition, a battle between army forces led by General St. Clair and Native American tribes. And the Native American tribes won. And then there's this great inquest in Congress as to sort of who's to blame. And in particular, whether blame should be put on Secretary of War Henry Knox, or whether St. Clair himself is responsible. They wind up calling for documents both from the War Department and from the Treasury Department. Alexander Hamilton delivers the documents in person that are coming from the Treasury Department. It's sort of widely discussed at the time. It's understood as sort of a big moment and an important investigation and a sort of important moment in early conflict between the branches and also between the parties. Partisanship is important from the beginning. So you don't really have parties yet in 1792, but you do have a sort of identifiably sort of nascent Federalist faction and an identifiably nascent Jeffersonian faction. And they're predictably on opposite sides of this. So right from the beginning, there's this idea of sort of public clash, of it having consequences, and of it interacting with other kinds of cleavages, with sort of partisanship and things like that.
And based on your research, I mean, is it your impression that the Congress had at that time this idea that they were speaking to the public directly, or was it more sort of an interaction with the presidency, and sort of the merits of it were in the asking and receiving of the facts and the information? Like, did it have this sort of rhetorical or performative quality to it at that time?
Absolutely. There's a recognition, especially in the House of Representatives from the very beginning, that part of what it's doing is interacting with the public. In fact, until 1795, the Senate met behind closed doors and the House met publicly. And a big part of what forces the Senate to begin opening up its proceedings is that the public in Philadelphia, well, first New York and then Philadelphia, is viewing sort of going to the House of Representatives as a sort of fun day out, as an aspect of entertainment, as one of the things you would do on the social circuit of the national capital. And that's actually giving the House more power vis-a-vis the Senate. And ultimately that convinces the Senate that, hey, we've got to open our proceedings as well. So there's a sense right from the beginning that interacting with the public and making sure the public sort of not only understands what you're doing, but that you're presenting it to them in the best possible light is really important.
Your article reminded me of actually a podcast that Ben Wittes had done on the Lawfare podcast over several years ago, actually at this point, maybe a year and a half ago, about a book called The Rhetorical Presidency, which was written by a political science named Jeffrey Tullis. And he, in that book sort of, and in the podcast, which I commend to all our listeners, he talks about how the speaking style of presidents changed from the founding era through the 19th century and into the 20th century. Then he sort of connects it to, or in the podcast, they connect it to this hyper rhetorical style of Donald Trump. And my question for you, and then later Woodrow Wilson sort of reinterpreted the presidency and began speaking more directly to the American people instead of sort of primarily speaking to the legislature itself. I mean, do you think that the sort of success of the House of Representatives and sort of presenting its face to the public was part of that that transition in terms of having an impact on the presidency itself and how the presidency presents itself?
Well, I think, so first of all, I should say, I think Jeff Tulis's book is fantastic, and I highly recommend that people take a look at it. And I think it's, you know, it's been very formative for my own work. I think that, you know, if I had one criticism of that book, I think it's maybe a little bit too linear in its presentation. I think that it might be sort of, or the way I would characterize it is that different presidents have had different styles of interacting with the public, and that it hasn't necessarily been a sort of straight line, or there haven't been these sort of one-way inflection points. You know, we can talk about presidents who have a sort of especially good or an especially effective public presentation. So someone like Andrew Jackson would be on that list. Sort of much earlier than say Woodrow Wilson, and someone who's sort of known for taking a case directly to the public. And then there have been presidents who've tried to take their case directly to the public and have caused significant backlash in doing so. So Andrew Johnson would be an example of that in the 19th century. So I think there's, you know, there have been different speaking styles by presidents, and likewise, there have been different speaking styles by members of Congress, by houses of Congress, and different levels of effectiveness and kinds of effectiveness over time. And because a lot of what they're doing is seeking to sort of assert their own positions vis-a-vis one another, right? President on the one hand, House on another, Senate on another, courts, I would say, by the way, do this as well. Because they're sort of constantly interacting with each other and trying to assert their power vis-a-vis one another, there are all these interaction effects, right? So a particularly effective president at communicating with the public will have certain effects on how Congress, you know, whether they try to sort of step up to meet that or whether they wind up being sort of cowed by that. And likewise, sort of presidents who have weaker public standing will often find themselves met with a Congress that tries to step into the breach. So we see that, you know, in the 19th century in the John Tyler administration and in the 20th century, we see that with some of the post-Watergate presidents, for example.
And so taking that sort of historical journey there. In your article, you talk about, you have two case studies in particular. One is the munitions inquiry from the mid-1930s, and then the more well-known, I'd say McCarthy, and then the Army-McCarthy hearings in the 1950s. Walk us through those case studies. Why did you choose those two to sort of showcase your thesis about sort of congressional speech?
Sure. So I think there's a series of reasons I wanted to choose those. You know, one is that it is true that although there, you know, there have been these hearings and this sort of importance attributed to congressional oversight from the earliest days of the Republic, it becomes more prominent with the rise of the administrative state, which makes a certain amount of sense, right? As the executive branch and independent agencies sort of grow in power, so too Congress perceives a sort of need to engage in more oversight. So to my mind, it made sense to sort of focus on 20th century examples. And I wanted to use examples with very different media of communication. So, you know, these two case studies are at the end of the article. Up until that point, I use a lot of more contemporary examples. So I talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I talk about, you know, things that have happened under the Trump administration. I talk a little bit about Iran-Contra, things like that. But I wanted to sort of use things that had happened in earlier moments and with different media of communication. So the munitions inquiry is largely about print media and with a sort of secondary role for radio. And then McCarthy and Army McCarthy is largely a story about television. So I wanted to suggest that, you know, although the media of communication matter here and they affect what counts as sort of good, effective uses of these tools that I characterize as congressional overspeech, that nevertheless, the sort of phenomenon continues across different media environments. And then I also wanted to sort of emphasize that, you know, just because this is a powerful and important tool doesn't mean it's always used for good, right? So it's important in McCarthy's fall, which I regard as a good thing, but it's also important in McCarthy's rise, right? McCarthy is very effective at using oversight as a mechanism of public communication. Right? So the mere fact that it's an important tool for members of Congress to do their job doesn't mean they're always doing normatively good things with it. And I wanted I wanted that to be prominent in the piece as well.
And so, yes, your premise is that this congressional overspeech, quote, overspeech, which I think is a word that you
have coined at this point. And you say it's an institutionally valuable one, providing Congress with important tools to compete with the other branches for public support and therefore for power. But tell me about that word overspeech. How did you land on that term? Because to me, it carries a bit of a pejorative, just attaching the word over to it. It's almost like too much speech or the wrong kind of speech or something. But I don't think that's how you mean it. So tell us about that term, congressional overspeech.
Right. So I was thinking of it in sort of two ways. One is just as a play on the idea of congressional oversight, because the idea is that it's the use of tools that are sort of mechanisms that are traditionally associated with oversight, but it's their use for communicative purposes. And then the second was that it, you know, might in circumstances allow members of Congress, committees of Congress, or houses of Congress to actually speak over the president in a certain way, to actually get their message out there in a way that can be just as effective as mechanisms of presidential communication. You know, we're used to thinking that the president really does have the bully pulpit. And much of the time that's true, but it is also the case that Congress has ways of focusing attention. It has tools it can use. It has moments it can take advantage of. And when it does that, it can attract public attention on a scale similar to that of the president. And so I wanted to emphasize that this actually does allow Congress in certain circumstances, or parts of Congress in certain circumstances, to speak over the president.
And just related to that, in your article, you talk about sort of the resting norm of how we think of congressional oversight, in the sense that you often hear this. I hear it from family and friends that hearing, that Mueller hearing or whatever, Benghazi hearing, it was so political. It was so politicized. It was so over the top. And so it's almost like the premise is like the virtuous hearing or the virtuous congressional oversight would just be purely fact-based, and Congress would just collect facts and make sense of them and try to make government better. But you're saying that's sort of like a false premise.
Well, there are certainly hearings that look more like, I refer to that idea as this sort of consensus ideal. And you know, I'd spend some time in the piece noting that, you know, people across the ideological and partisan spectrum sort of talk as if that is what characterizes good oversight, right? It's just about receiving the facts. It's about fact-finding, right? It's nonpartisan. It's civil. And there is plenty of congressional oversight activity that actually does look more or less like that. The thing is, people don't, you know, most sort of people who don't follow Congress closely don't know about that activity, in part because it doesn't attract public attention, right? That it's so what they see, you know, what does actually make the news is the oversight activity that looks more like overspeech. And that in itself should sort of perhaps give people some pause, right? If the stuff that they think of as virtuous gets no attention whatsoever, and they're not paying attention to it, that might suggest that it's that their idea of what constitutes virtue has a lot in common with inefficacy. Whereas the things that look, you know, and I have trouble with this word political, right? What would you expect political institutions to engage in, if not politics? But the things that sort of look political in the way people are using it in that sense are the things that are meant to sort of directly engage with the public. And we want Congress to engage with the public. We want Congress to both reflect public opinion, help to shape public opinion, if it's ever going to be able to sort of stand up to the other branches. It's got to do so by enlisting the public on its side, and it's got to therefore engage in effective communication with the public. And so my argument in this article is that a lot of, you know, that the tools of congressional oversight give it ways of effectively engaging with and convincing the public, and that when it can successfully use those tools, it has sort of empowered itself in really important ways.
So I think when I think of when people use the word political as a criticism, I think what they are intuiting is more sort of what seems to them to be not a good faith sort of cooperative effort at governance. And your article kind of got me thinking about, and you talk about this in the article, you know, how people react to congressional overspeech. And I think at one point you say there is a tendency that it sort of reifies or just enhances existing political leanings. And so I was thinking, as a concrete example, you know, when you ask some people, you know, what they thought of the Benghazi hearing, some people will say, well, you know, that was really good, it was necessary to do. And other people are like, oh, it was totally politicized and not a good faith inquiry. By the same token, and I've talked to people about this, you know, you ask them about, well, what'd you think of the Ukraine impeachment inquiry? And it's like, oh, it was totally politicized. And other people say, oh, you know, that was a good thing, I'm glad they did that. So, you know, what are the sort of different reactions from, based on political party, you know, what does that say about, you know, why is this congressional overspeech valuable if what it tends to do in a lot of instances is kind of solidify your existing, you know, ideological or partisan views?
Right. So I think there's sort of two things I would say in response to that. One is that congressional hearings don't just solidify existing views. So we know this. So Doug Kreiner and Eric Schickler have a fantastic book called Investigating the President, where they look at basically all hearings, all congressional hearings aimed at presidential oversight between 1953 and 2014. So well into the current era of partisan polarization. And they found that when you increase the number of days of hearings investigating the president, it decreases presidential approval ratings. And that finding is robust over time. It's robust over unified versus divided government. So people do actually change their views based on congressional oversight. So that's sort of one thing that's worth emphasizing. But another thing, you know, I do say, right, one thing that overspeech can be is divisive, right? So on the consensus view, right, oversight ought to aim at building consensus. And I say, well, that's, you know, sometimes maybe something it should aim at doing. But other times, perhaps what it should or what it aims at and what it can effectively do is preach to the choir. You know, choirs need to be preached to sometimes. And one thing that effective political leaders do is not just try to win over people who don't already support them, although they do that, but also try to rally their own supporters. And that's an important part of politics. And sometimes that's an important thing that overspeech can do is sort of get all of your followers on the same page. It can reinforce their views. It can help them sort of understand what the party line is. And we actually saw this with the Mueller hearings, for example. So one of the takeaways after the Mueller hearings that you heard a lot was it didn't convince anyone, because you look at polling from right before the Mueller hearings and right after the Mueller hearings, and things like support for impeaching the president remain almost exactly at the same levels. But if you look more closely at those polls, it turns out that what the hearings did, was they convinced Democrats to be more supportive of impeachment and Republicans to be less supportive of impeachment. So the Mueller hearings actually further polarized the public. Now, if you're the Democrats in the House, that's actually potentially a good outcome from the Mueller hearings. And we see this sort of after the Mueller hearings, but before the Ukraine stuff starts coming out, you see sort of high-profile Democrats in the House lining up behind impeachment in ways that they hadn't before. So you have these sort of hearings that sway that sort of further push the Democratic public towards impeaching the president, which then has a sort of rebound effect and further convinces Democratic leadership in Congress to support impeachment. Right? That's a sort of important form of political organizing, even though it doesn't actually involve sort of reaching across the aisle in any way.
I just want to dwell on this for a little bit, because I do think that, you know, it's hard to let go of the idea that what oversight should really be about is finding facts, and if there's a problem, trying to correct it. If someone has engaged in something like impeachable conduct, that should be called out for reasons of sort of reinforcing sort of what I think of as American traditional sort of moral norms about our democracy. I do think the media environment plays a role. So I just want to you know, in your example, in the McCarthy hearings, you talk about how Edward R. Murrow devoted 30 minutes of his show on CBS to condemning McCarthy and his tactics. And that was sort of repeated over a number of different media outlets. There were obviously fewer media outlets then. And that was sort of a moment that the American public generally kind of said, gee, what McCarthy's doing here doesn't really seem to be consistent with my, what I think of as my American values. And it was instrumental in, I think, changing the view of what McCarthy was doing there. My sense at the current moment is we don't have something like that. We don't have a unifying media voice like Edward R. Murrow to sort of put it together and speak to, you know, a broad swath of Americans and traditional American values. I don't think you're saying that it's sort of unimportant what the aim of the oversight is, but are we ever going to have something like that in our current media environment, which is so disparate, so many outlets, so many media outlets competing for basically attention of Americans and what they think of as their values?
Right. Well, so one thing I would note is, so the Murrow attack on McCarthy doesn't come until 1954. You know, March 1954. And so, it takes a long time. You know, we have this idea that sort of the establishment, you know, the sort of cross-partisan establishment turned on McCarthy from early on. And that's just not true. Eisenhower, it was known in political circles that Eisenhower hated McCarthy, but he basically refused to sort of mention McCarthy by name. And when he finally does criticize him, it's very tepid. A lot of other Republicans refuse to criticize McCarthy. It's really just Ralph Flanders of Vermont and Margaret Chase Smith, who are the sort of two Republicans in the Senate who really go after McCarthy. Flanders, I mean, it sort of sounds like Jeff Flake. Like, Flanders doesn't go after McCarthy until after he's already announced that he's not running again in the next election. And Flanders isn't running again. So I think in retrospect, we may tend to overstate the extent to which his fellow Republicans turned on McCarthy, especially before the Army McCarthy hearings. And in terms of media environment, you know, I think, again, for a long time, the criticism is fairly tepid. You know, for a long time, the major national outlets, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the networks, repeat McCarthy's charges sort of prominently above the fold, every day, every week. You see a lot, you could make a lot of the same criticisms that people make of the press now, that they repeat what he says, and it's only, several paragraphs later that they get into whether there's any actual evidence for them or things like that. But you are right that the media environment is less fractured in the middle of the 20th century. And in that sense, the sort of aberrational period is actually not today, it's the mid-20th century. You know, for before that, you had a highly partisan media environment, really from the 18th century all the way through the 19th century and into the early 20th century. We're in sort of an environment now that looks more like the norm in American history, where you have a somewhat more partisan media environment. So I think it would be hard for someone to play the role of sort of at least the role that we attribute to Murrow in that context. I think that's probably right.
And so just as we reflect on the last 2 years, I guess it would be since the Democrats came into power in the House, obviously there were the Mueller hearings, there was the impeachment inquiry. I mean, would you say that it's sort of too soon or too early to know really what impact those sets of hearings have had or are having on our sort of constitutional democratic culture?
I think, I think everything's going to depend on what happens in the election this year, in the sense that, we tend to read elections as public judgments on what has gone before. I think that, and this, by the way, is, when I talk about the sort of importance of public communication, not the only reason, but one reason is that, all of these politicians are aimed at election and at re-election. And so part of what they're trying to do is make the case that, hey, you should trust me and my team over them and their team. And so a lot of, when we look back 10 years from now, a lot of the way we talk about the 2020 election is going to be, did the American people choose to repudiate Trump, or did they choose to reward him with a second term? And if they chose to reward him with a second term, that's going to be seen as a repudiation of Democratic attempts to check him. So we're going to have to wait and see both what happens in the 2020 election and then how, sort of as a political community, we decide to read what happens in the 2020 election, right? We sort of construct these post hoc narratives about elections. And that's really, 10, 20, 30 years from now, when we talk about this time period, what story we choose to tell about it is going to depend on sort of how we understand the 2020 election.
As part of that, obviously, Congress is in meeting and in session. The House, as you know, recently voted to do a form of proxy voting so that not all of the members of the House need to be in the chamber at the same time. And they're doing that because of the chance of transmission, obviously, of the coronavirus. Another part of what the House did is that they made it possible for committee proceedings to be conducted remotely, basically. And the Senate has done a little bit of that as well. What do you think the idea of remote hearings, what does it do to this idea of overspeech? I was having trouble imagining a senator or a congressman sort of in his home office back in the district, sort of ranting and raving into his computer, or her computer, the same way he or she might be perceived to sort of rant and rave in the immediacy and the presence of being in the hearing room. So what do you think of the idea of remote hearings? What does it do to the idea of congressional overspeech in your view?
I think it's a great question. So I think it's, we've talked a couple times about the importance of media and in some sense, the idea of media specificity, right? That sort of effective overspeech looks different in the 1930s in the munitions hearings, where we're talking about, mostly print media and a little bit of radio, than it does in the 50s with McCarthy and Army McCarthy, where we're talking about television. And it looks very different today when we're talking about, Twitter and short video clips on the internet. So if remote hearings become a sort of more common feature of our landscape, if, for example, they continue even after the pandemic has passed, then I think members and committees are going to need to think about sort of how to stage them effectively. And that's going to mean things, it sounds silly, but that's going to mean thinking about things like, well, what do you have in the background when you're speaking, right? It's not a coincidence that congressional committee rooms are designed to look sort of imposing and formal, right? And you lose some of that if you have a really informal or silly looking background behind you. It's going to mean thinking about, well, okay, if we're doing this on computers anyway, are there things we can integrate into it, right? Do we want members of Congress in at least some context to be sort of able to put up sort of PowerPoint presentations sort of while they're speaking or things like that. And, that happens a little bit in committee
rooms.
Screen
share bombing type.
Exactly. How do we want to handle interruptions, right? Does the chair, get to mute members? Right? All kinds of issues are going to arise that are going to go to the question of, okay, what makes for effective congressional communication in the context of remote meetings, in the context of a situation where you're not all in the same room. And that's going to look different than it's looked in the past, but it always looks different depending on what the media of communications are. So I think there's going to have to be, again, if this becomes regularized, there's going to have to be some rethinking of how it's done. But in some sense, that's both a point of departure from the past and a point of continuity, because they're always sort of rethinking what it means to effectively use these kinds of proceedings to communicate.
All right, last question. Your name is Josh Chaffetz. You write about congressional oversight and other congressional issues. How often do you get mistaken on Twitter or elsewhere for being Jason Chaffetz, also a famous name? He's a Republican congressman from Utah who chaired the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform from 2015 until 2017. He is someone everyone will remember from that time period in the run-up to the election. So yeah, you, Josh Chaffetz versus Jason Chaffetz.
All the time. I can tell when he's in, it's less so now that he's out of the House, but I can always tell when he said something controversial, both when he was a member and now on Fox News, because my Twitter mentions just light up. So all the time.
Are you glad? Is it like help raise your profile on these issues?
It's not usually people who want to compliment him who wind up coming into my Twitter mentions. So I think I could do without that. But
well, if I ever have If I ever have Matt Gaetz on the podcast, I will ask him the same question with respect to Matt Gaetz.
He and I have a support organization.
Josh, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Don't forget to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also purchase Lawfare merchandise at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. We would also appreciate your support for our nonprofit endeavors at lawfareblog.com/support-lawfare. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo Studios was our audio engineer. As always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.